Committee on Ways and Means for January 31st, 2005. I actually asked the members to do a little bit of homework since last Friday and basically just give a short introduction of themselves, anything that they'd like to say, probably just a few words. So I'm going to start, not intentionally and not meaning that that's anything to do with political affiliation, at my far left with Representative March.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and it's a bit unusual in that I'm sort of an ex officio member of the committee at this stage. I'm a Ways and Means Subcommittee wannabe. My name's Steve March. I represent a district in the center of Portland. It has Laurelhurst Center, Montevilla, Mount Tabor, South Tabor, Foster Powell, parts of Mount Scott, Arleta, Lentz, and Powellhurst-Gilbert neighborhoods. I have two high schools within my district, numerous middle and others. I've had credentials, teaching secondary teaching credentials in Oregon and in California. I've got a doctorate in urban studies from Portland State, and let's see, I've been very interested in education. I understudied all last session in this committee, and back again, still wanting to be on this committee. So, Madam Speaker, if you're listening, we have a vacancy created by the elevation of Representative Betsy Johnson, and that's why it would be, there's not currently a Democrat on this sub, but we hope to fill that this week. Thank you.
Representative Wisnett.
Mr. Chair, a couple of the senators here have heard this before, but I'm honored to serve as District 53 state representative. District 53 is rural Deschutes County, Oregon's season year-round playground that I haven't been able to use much lately. I read my black book this weekend, so on the way over to Sun River to pay my bills and get some fresh clothes. It's an honor to serve on this committee. During the interim after I was appointed in September of 2003, I served on the House Interim Education Committee. So I've had at least a year and a half to try to get up to speed on our issues and what we need to make our education better and accountable. I look forward to serving. My background is I served 27 and a half years in the military. I'm a product of public education, and so is my son back east. Sort of get some people's attention. Again, I apologize to a couple of the senators for hearing this. My experience is retired military, a diplomat, a spy, and a politician. So.
Senator Gordon.
Thank you, and good morning. It is a pleasure and a delight to be serving again on the Education Subcommittee of Ways and Means. This is an assignment that I have had going back to my days in the House of Representatives, and now here in the Senate. I think this is my second or third time around on this this committee. I have a long-standing interest and concern about how we design our educational system so that it meets the needs of all of our children. We have had some issues around and challenges around meeting the needs of children of color in our classrooms and low-income white students as well. And so I have tried to use my position on this committee and my voice on this committee as a reminder that we must do a better job of serving those children who have historically and traditionally been left behind, even before we had a national or a federal initiative tagged Leave No Child Behind. I put my work in a historical perspective, Mr. Chair and members. It was in the 1920s here in Oregon that Beatrice Kennedy, an African-American woman who lived in southwest Portland, decided to run for the school board. And she ran on a platform of creating a quality, non-racist education for all children. That was in the 1920s. The same woman, Beatrice Kennedy, also ran for a seat in the legislature. She didn't win either of those seats, but my point is that roughly 80 years later, we are still struggling with the same issues, the same challenges around serving the needs of all of our children. So you can count on me to be a voice around issues of equity and opportunity, and I bring my experience having served in Portland on the Portland Public Schools Desegregation Monitoring and Advisory Committee. I've worked with Albina Head Start and its parent program. I have organized and coordinated a Saturday school program for hundreds of children who needed help with math and reading, and whose parents wanted them to have access to information about their history and culture. Again, that's a part of the passion I bring, and again, I just cannot underscore enough how important it is for us to focus on the needs of the children who have been underserved. This state is leading the way now with a multicultural competency and education initiative. It is an initiative that has been recognized at the national level. Recently in November, we had the New York Times and National Public Radio out to capture what's going on here in Oregon. I'm going to leave it up to Superintendent Castillo and Dr. Pat Burke and others with the department to describe what those efforts look like and how, again, Oregon is leading the way. But let's let our efforts this session be about lifting up the needs of all of Oregon's children. Thank you.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. My name is David Nelson, a state senator from Pendleton, Oregon. I'm the rural voice from Eastern Oregon on this committee, and I think that we've bridged the urban-rural gap already this morning, because I think I share the same concerns that Senator Gorley does. I'd maybe look at them a little bit differently. What I always tell her is that in the city, you guys are worried about drive-by shootings. Out in my part of the country, we're worried about children walking down country pass and getting attacked by a cougar. So we have a little bit of difference of opinion on what's important and how we get there. But I think the overall feeling is that we need to do some changes in education. We have to start doing things differently. And this budget and monetary crisis that we have is going to force us to do that. There's going to be some pretty hard decisions, I think, being made on this committee. I know that Senator Courtney, President Courtney, when he made the selections, tried to do a geographical representation. I intend to be the rural voice on this area, but I have a great compassion for things that are happening also in the urban areas and for the state of Oregon. In one of the previous meetings, I said that we were looking for love in all the wrong places. And it's an old country western song. It's just in the jukeboxes, places I used to attend. It's one of the favorite songs that we used to listen to. And I think that's really true. We're talking about a decline in education, and I think that the superintendent will be talking about that this morning. But I would just like to put something out there for your thought, is that the decline in public education pretty much declines the parallel. There's parallel the decline that we have in our natural resources. Paul Warner, who's our legislative revenue fellow, gave me a sheet of paper showing me of the 50 states, how many of those states have a surplus. And there's 12 in the United States, 12 out of 50. Eight of them are west of the Mississippi River. One's Nevada, has gambling. One's Hawaii that has tourism, special niches. The other eight are basically have a severance tax or some sort of tax on natural resources. You can spell Utopia A-L-A-S-K-A. Did I spell that right? Alaska. They have a $600 million surplus this year. They do not have a sales tax. They do not have an income tax, but they have a lot of oil. So what I'm saying to these folks and to people in all the state of Oregon, start looking at what Oregon is really good at. What do we really do well? And one of the things is we grow trees. The other thing is we have a huge amount of water in the Columbia River that is, we're not using it for the public benefit. So if you're looking for love in the right places, let's start looking at some of our natural resources. If we need this money to fund public services, we're going to have to start changing the way we're looking at the world and not be so politically correct.
Thank you. Senator Walker.
Good morning. Hard to follow my two esteemed colleagues.
If we're angry. No, we're not.
Well, I'm Vicki Walker, and I'm a senator from Eugene. Also represent Junction City, a small school district that relied on the Grange, the Long Tom Grange, to help fund their programs. And the Long Tom Grange put out a calendar of naked men. You know, and it's quote-unquote naked. Well, they are naked, but they're covered up discreetly. But it touched off quite a storm of controversy in that very quiet little community. Some people thought it was disgraceful. Others thought, why not? We need the money. Because the Grange has given the school district a great deal of money as a result of those calendar sales. I say we shouldn't have to fund education by selling calendars of naked men or naked women. We should fund education because it's important and it's the right thing to do. And as Senator Gordley indicated, it's been a problem we've been addressing for many, many years. I'm pleased to be here. It wasn't my first assignment because this is a difficult assignment. My first foray into ways and means is going to be one that's very interesting, very rewarding, very telling about how we do budgeting, and we are starting a new way of budgeting here this session, so I'm looking forward to that. And I'm looking forward to making sure that every child has the opportunity to succeed in this state, and that my friend who now has a child in school and called me over the weekend and said, what are we going to do about education funding? I'm not going to let her down. I'm not going to let the rest of Oregon down. And we're going to do the best that we can do. And I'm happy to be here.
Senator Witz.
I'm Doug Witzet, Senate District 28. It's entirely a rural district. I include Klamath Falls, Cranville, Lakeview, Eagle Point as rural towns. My district includes Klamath, Lake, Crook, and parts of Deschutes and Jackson counties. I'm a retired veterinarian, farmer, horse breeder, small businessman for 35 years. My family's been invested in education for forever. I'm a veterinarian, of course. My wife is a petroleum geologist with advanced degrees in Oregon State. I have a daughter who's a dental hygienist, another daughter who's a graduate of Oregon State in biology. My youngest daughter is attending Willamette and languages. Our Klamath Animal Clinic over the years provided high school preceptorships for more than 30 students. Since 1980, the Klamath Animal Clinic has provided an externship for veterinary students at the clinic, and I'm proud to say that 19 of our clinic graduates are now hold DVM degrees. We spend $6.4 billion. We plan to spend $6.4 billion on K-12 education. And it's 550,000 students, 54,000 employees. It's one employee for every 10.6 students. And it's over $11,000 per student that we're spending. And it's unclear in reviewing the literature whether that includes fees, whether that includes the Multnomah income tax, Multnomah County income tax surcharge, and it's unclear whether that also includes the capital expenditures, but it's a lot of money. We must get more for the $11,000 we spend per students. Thank you.
Richard Devlin, Senator from Senate District 19. I represent Lake Oswego, West Lynn, Tualatin, portions of Lower Southwest Portland, including the Dunthorpe area of unincorporated Multnomah County. I have two small communities of River Grove and Durham, and my only claim to any rural identity is the Stafford Basin in Clackamas County, which average home values probably in the $500,000 to $1 million range. So, but I would like to say two things. One, by way of just two antidotes in a sense. I began looking at school funding issues and the quality of education when my son was in third grade. Have been very interested in it ever since. Have been very worried about the level of public support and the level of funding for public education. My son is now a senior at Linfield College, so it's been a goodly number of years. In my district, I often, on my first occasion with any group, retell a story. And the story is about a young child who was born in Oregon in the early 1950s, whose family went to Montana for a short period of time and then came back and settled in Northern California. In the first grade, the child never learned how to read. In the second grade, the child still did not learn how to read. Small rural school district. The child's parents were told that the child was probably very slow, probably would never graduate from high school, and some people probably still believe that part about being very slow. Went back to Oregon schools in the third grade. A teacher discovered in the third grade that that student squinted literally at everything he looked at, that could not really see the chalkboard, and for the first time in the third grade, the school district actually made it possible for the student to receive an eye exam, determined that the student was extremely farsighted, obtained glasses, provided the student with a tutor for almost, I think, 6 months out of that year. And in the fourth grade, that student read more books than any other student in that elementary school. And I'm that student, so. Now, I cite that story to recognize a couple of things. One, that teacher was in a classroom that was small enough so she recognized the individual needs of her student. That school district had the resources to meet the individual needs of that student in terms of providing that student with a tutor, I believe, for almost 6 months. And they took an active interest in that student's production. I would like to say that that is actually why I constantly think about education, and I constantly think about primary school students and the fact that we either make lives possible for them or we deprive them of the lives that they're possible for them by the type of education we provide in our public education system. I'll leave it at that, and I would like to actually recognize for the committee Sue McGlashan, who you will see a lot of, and I probably mispronounced her last name. And she will be here for the Department of Education, the State School Fund, maybe in a few other capacities. And everyone actually has met Diane Myers, the committee assistant. And with that, we will get on to the work of the committee. And we have a very honored guest here this morning, Representative Susan Castillo, the Department of Education, Superintendent of the Department of Education.
Well, thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Susan Castillo, the Superintendent of Public Instruction, and we very much look forward to working with you this session and addressing all of the issues that every one of you has just raised for us this morning, including how much we spend per pupil in Oregon, and look forward to giving you lots of good factual information on that. I just want to begin by saying how proud I am to be the superintendent of Oregon Public Schools. The students, teachers, administrators, classified, and other professionals in our schools are fantastic. I am so thankful and grateful for their dedication, long hours, and hard work in the face of huge challenges. We have wonderful schools delivering success every day for our students, and I know that because I have been out visiting schools over the last 2 years. I have been to over 50 districts and visited over 100 schools, and I have seen firsthand what is happening in Oregon schools, both urban and rural. It is truly awesome, and I consider myself lucky to work with such a top-flight group of individuals. Oregon is fortunate to have a resource like our public schools and the many people who care about them. The challenges facing K through 12 education in Oregon are nothing new to any of us. The legislature, school administrators, teachers, students, and parents are dealing with harsh realities of funding education during difficult economic times. The choices are hard, and the consequences can last a lifetime. While budgets have declined, expectations remain high. Students look to us to give them the tools they need to become productive members of society. Parents look to us to provide their children with an education that is as good as or better than the one they had. Teachers demand the tools necessary to provide that education. Administrators seek a balance between the demands of the classroom and the demands of accountability. The public wants assurance that they are getting a return on their investment in education. The federal government, through its No Child Left Behind Act, makes many demands it only partially funds. But on the positive note, test scores remain strong at the elementary level with more work to do at middle and high school. The dropout rate is declining, and the achievement gap between high-performing students and those challenged by language, disability, and poverty is beginning to close. And additional federal funds for the implementation of No Child Left Behind are helping, especially at our Title I schools. There are, however, reasons to be concerned about what's happening in our education system. Funding is inadequate and unstable. Our schools have lost over 1,000 teachers and administrators due to budget cuts since 2002. Class sizes are 30% larger than the rest of the United States. Some are standing room only. Our school year is one of the shortest in the nation. Some states have nearly 20 more school days than Oregon. We have seen a leveling off in reading and math achievement, especially in the middle and high school levels. Hours of instructional time remain above the required minimum, but have declined at most grade levels. The loss of counselors, music teachers, physical education, and librarians represent a decline in the overall educational experience and fewer electives. And programs for early childhood and pre-kindergarten education, programs that research has proven to be effective for kids as well as cost-effective for all of us, are not funded and expanded in a way that makes sense. In fact, we are moving backwards, funding fewer students each year. Let me talk a little about the decline in state school funding. I have been very vocal about my belief that we need more money for basic school support. But I also believe that we need to ask tough questions about whether we're making the best use of every dollar that we have now. At the department level, we've taken a hard look at our mission. We've reorganized the individual offices and reduced management positions, all while adding duties as mandated by No Child Left Behind. In the past, the Oregon Department of Education has been accused of not being forthcoming with information. Well, we have changed that. We are responsive to the executive and legislative branches of government, as well as to our superintendents, school boards, parents, school children, and taxpayers. Today, you can find information about any school district on our webpage, including funding and spending information, and we continue to expand upon this. In the past, the department's role was one of regulation and requirements. And today, it is one of giving schools the tools they need to be successful and then holding them accountable for performance and results, both academic and financial. You'll hear more about the reorganization, the proposal for an integrated data system and a more fair and accurate system of accountability than the current state report card from Vicki and Brett. At the district and ESD level, the department is looking for ways to reduce costs for student transportation, business functions, and staff health insurance. We have been looking at the ESD system in terms of function, in terms of number, and in terms of what our responsibilities are to ensure that education service districts provide the services our kids need at the most efficient cost possible. And in this era of increased accountability, data is very important in education. Districts are required to forward to us their information. However, we are eliminating redundancy in requests. We're working on it. Educating children takes precedence over filling out multiple data request forms from the state, and it should. Even though data demands have increased significantly, the department has reduced its request for paperwork from districts by 10%, and we continue to work to make this process more timely and accurate at less cost. The Department of Education, the legislature, and the public need to recognize that Oregon has shifted from a locally funded education system to one funded by the state. Between 1979 and 1990, 70% of school funding came from local property taxes and 30% came from the state general fund. But since passage of Measure 5, that ratio has essentially reversed. All of this is to say that our role changes. The need for us to be accountable grows. Internally, we are accountable for making our operations as lean and focused as possible and getting kids the services they need. Externally, we need to hold all schools accountable for results for the funds they receive and make school operations as transparent as possible so that our communities can see how schools are spending money and bring about change if it is not spent appropriately. And while we are also accountable to the federal government and their mandates, our first allegiance is to Oregon. When a federal mandate doesn't make sense, we have taken our concerns to the feds, and with our U.S. senators, we have fought for what we think will work for Oregon, while not lessening our overall accountability responsibilities. And we have won changes in the law, and we will continue to work for more. Adding to our challenges is the growing diversity of Oregon's school population. The number of minority students as a percent of all students continues to grow. Between 1992 and 2004, the total number of all students increased by 41,193. Our minority student population accounted for most of that increase, especially with Hispanic students. 11% of our students speak at least one of 138 non-English languages. The schools of today are not the same schools that you all attended. These changes are placing increased demands on our schools for language instruction and cultural competency. Poverty and the challenges it brings is also increasing. In 1992, 31% of our students qualified for free and reduced lunches. In 2004, that percentage has increased to 40%. And also the demands of rural school districts differ greatly from those in urban areas. For example, transportation in southeastern Oregon is a different problem than it is in Wilsonville. Retaining a new teacher in Nyssa is a different problem than it is in West Lynn. And in this new environment, it is imperative that the department focus on leadership, accountability, school improvement, delivery of services, and increased collaboration and communication. Last year, I asked the department to pursue the following priorities necessary to achieve these goals. That children be ready to learn upon entering first grade, that we continue to close the achievement gap, that we improve reading and writing skills at all grades, that we improve school and district leadership. We know how important that is to creating success in our schools. That we make every school a community school. And finally, that we improve academic achievement in middle schools and high schools. I have brought together in the department a broad group of leaders with strong backgrounds in the private sector and education. And this group represents a new era for the department with new ways of thinking and doing business. The Department of Education, as reflected in the proposed 2005-2007 budget, is much different than the one of 2 years ago and will be even more different 2 years from now. This budget is designed to recognize that the department and the entire Oregon education system are in transition. And your consideration of this budget will take place against the backdrop of several important issues. The appropriate level of state school support to deliver the results we all want, which is more success for all kids. Whether to expand the existing local option for funding schools. The future of school reform that was passed in the 90s. reconciling two competing and conflicting systems of measuring success, one from the federal government and one from the Oregon legislature in the state report card. The role of the department in the accountability for education dollars from its 198 school districts. The department staff is made up of former teachers and others who have held a lifelong commitment to students and education. They work every day to bring best practices to our schools and to help students be the best that they can be. And I am honored to work among such a dedicated group of state employees who have shouldered additional responsibilities cheerfully and have been willing to work extra hours to do what is right for our schools and our students. And it's not just about working hard. Employees have weathered the changes that come from being an agency in transition in order to approach the work differently. The department no longer just collects and reports information. It is deeply involved in providing support, guidance, and expertise to schools and school districts on everything from school buses and school lunch to applying for grants and using federal dollars more effectively. So I look forward to having a frank and honest discussion with the committee about the work that lies ahead of all of us. Thank you very much, and I'd be glad to answer any questions, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Superintendent. Any questions? Senator Gordley.
Thank you. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
I would first like to say how very blessed we are in Oregon to have the quality of your leadership. What you bring to the work, what you bring to the role is just is outstanding.
Thank you.
Thank you for what you do, and thank you for your cheerfulness. I want to ask about a couple of things brought out in your testimony. You said the dropout rate is declining. If, however, we disaggregate the data, would we find the dropout rate declining for Latino students?
We would when we start looking, the overall number, as you just said, is declining. But you're absolutely right, Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley. As you take a look at the disaggregated data, we have some serious challenges as we look at the different populations of students. And we know that we absolutely have to do a better job with all populations of students. And we have some challenges there with our Latino students, with our Black students, students in poverty, and we are focusing on that and have I believe are headed in the right direction as we are headed towards a more student-focused education system in Oregon that really really does try to address all of the issues why students do drop out of school. And oftentimes in our research, most of the time, the reasons are for reasons outside of the school. But we know we have serious challenges with some of our populations, and we have that absolutely. We are focused on that, and we don't want a single child to drop out of school in Oregon.
One additional question, Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
And you may want to ask Dr. Burt to assist with this question. From an education budget perspective, would you frame for us the issues around multicultural competence in education, what we are doing to move in that direction, why we must do it, and where we are with the effort? And what do you need from this legislative session in order to continue on the path?
Okay. Well, I will start, but if Dr. Burke wants to come up and help me answer this question, that would be great too. But we know that the diversity within our workforce is absolutely not keeping up with the diversity in our student population, and we are working to try to diversify the workforce, but we know we're not going to be able to keep pace. And so it is very, very important that we do everything we can to give our workforce the body of knowledge and the skills that they need to be successful with every single student that walks into an Oregon classroom. So we're going about this work in several ways. One of them is through a grant that we received from the Wallace Foundation that really focuses on leadership and leadership development. And in that work, which is a statewide effort, we have focused on cultural competency and literacy. We know that leadership in a school makes a huge difference on what's going to happen in the classroom. When you walk into a school and there is strong leadership, you can just feel it when you're in the building after a few minutes, and you know that students there are performing well, and you know that you have a sparked faculty and that there's lots of innovation in the building. And we need to do everything we can to help those in leadership positions in Oregon to have support and the training and the skills that they need to be successful and to help them with this. So we've really been focusing on the development of our leaders around cultural competency. And now, and I know, Senator Gordley, you have been involved in helping us with those efforts, but we now have cultural competency as a part of the requirement for administrative licensure in Oregon. And the rest of the country, as you said earlier, is really watching what we're doing in this area. We are providing some leadership in this country on how we're going about that work. And we are working also on another front, working very, very closely with all of the colleges of education in Oregon, both public and private, and partnering with them on how they train our educators and making sure that they're making progress, working with them in their efforts to make progress on cultural competency and having them, they're also going about examining their own programs with their own faculty. So there is a lot of exciting work happening there. And then, of course, with our teachers also, there's a lot of work going on with developing more cultural competency with our teachers. I know that the Oregon Education Association has been providing very strong leadership in this area and has been helping. And I know that there is some legislation this session as well that we'll be talking about. But there's a lot of interest. We're moving forward. We have a statewide group of people that are focused on this work, and as I said, we are getting some attention for the work that we're doing here. We have a ways to go. I think we're all learning as we're moving forward on this on the best way to achieve this, but we have some very exciting initiatives underway that I think are really going to help. Ultimately, that's the whole goal, is how do we help every single student feel connected in a positive way, have their families feel connected in a positive way, whatever their status or ethnicity is or their social conditions. We want to make sure that our workforce is trained to meet the needs of every single student.
Yes, Representative.
May we hear from Dr. Burke, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Gordley. Then we'll go to Representative Wisnett and then Senator Nelson.
Mr. Chair, good morning. For your record, I am Pat Burke. I'm the Chief Policy Officer for the department. One of the real privileges of working in the department currently is to be able to work with a superintendent who knows the issues so well. So you have already heard from the superintendent a very good discussion of this issue. Let me just put a numerical face on this. Currently, there are 23% of the Oregon student population is from a minority group. That number has increased significantly over the past 7 to 8 years. For example, during that period of time, Latino students in the state have increased over 171%. At the same time, only 4.7% of Oregon teachers represent minority or language groups. So there is this large gap between the diversity of our workforce and the diversity of our student body. So, Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley, in addition to the comments that the superintendent made, let me just add that we're trying to approach this on two fronts. One is to develop a more diverse workforce through working with the universities in the recruitment and retention and placement of teachers. And I must say, I would look forward to having the committee hear at some point about some of the work that the universities are doing in this area. Secondly, we have to do more to prepare our existing workforce, and that means better preparation in multicultural education and in giving them the tools that they need. I spend a lot of time talking with university folks related to teacher preparation, and this is also an area where our university community has really stepped up in adding issues of multicultural education and cultural competence to both teacher and administrator licensure programs. So, Mr. Chair, we're trying to work on both fronts, both the recruitment of a more diverse workforce and the better preparation of our existing workforce.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Wisner.
Hi, sir. Mr. Chair, Superintendent, thank you for your testimony. I think you've shown excellent leadership. Thanks for your comments.
I think you've shown excellent leadership.
I've had the privilege to work with a lot of great leaders. And I think times take leaders, strong leaders. And I think your leadership on the No Child Left Behind was a great example to us in Oregon that you didn't fight the system, you made some changes. I think we all need to do that. I've enjoyed in the last year and a half working with your people. They're very professional. I think they're dedicated. The statement you provided in writing, you didn't state it when you gave your testimony. But, Superintendent, I would ask, it's going to be a long 2 months, 3 months, 6 months. And the statement in your written testimony that we have people standing in classrooms and some people have chairs and no desk. If that's a true statement, as governor, I would be embarrassed. As superintendent, I would be embarrassed. And as a legislator, I am embarrassed. I wish we wouldn't use those sort of terms.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wisnett, it is the case. We have classrooms where children are standing because there isn't enough room for desks for them. I have a statewide student advisory team that is made up of students from eighth grade to high school, and they have identified class size as one of the issues that they want to work on and advise me this next year on. And they have stories that they shared with me about people going to class and people having to stand, and they get tired and they end up sitting on the floor in their classroom because they are such large classes, and that is what's happening in Oregon today.
Yes, Representative.
Superintendent, I would like to have the report of the exact schools and how many people and how many desks were short and how many chairs. That's an embarrassment to the state. And your department is in charge, and the school board should be embarrassed if they don't have desks and chairs for the students. I'm sorry, that's.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wisnett, I have to tell you that I actually am very pleased to see you that upset, because we should all be that upset. You are absolutely correct. We should not be allowing this to happen in our state. I'm sure that there are any number of superintendents and principals who would be more than happy to share with you the stories about what's happening with class size in the state of Oregon right now.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Susan. I agree with all the good things that have been said about you and the things that are going on. You know, it appears to me this, we're all getting down to the point where the demand is going to be for more money coming from just about everybody to solve these problems. And I think in the last session, the legislature did its job. We passed out temporary tax surcharge, but the voters said no, so we have to live with that. We have a potential of two lawsuits, the PERS situation and also with the MUPL money. We don't know how those are going to turn out. I mean, we have a potential that we're going to lose money. It's my understanding that the economy is picking up and we may pick up a little bit more money, but I don't think that we're ever going to get to the point in this session anywhere we're going to have enough money for the demands that public education is making on us. And that is potentially sad. When I look at Senate Bill 5509, which is actually your request for monies, when I look through all these requests, all of them except one have to do with children. The one that doesn't have to do with children is operations. And if we're looking at a situation where we have to make some cuts, it goes back to the operations of your department. I see from general fund we're $36 million approximately. Other funds, it's about $7 million. And federal funds, it's $42 million. I think that's... Sue, we're pretty close to all that. But what if we get down to the place where we say we have to make some more reductions and we have to come to your department and say, well, we're going to take $20 million out of your operations fund. I mean, what does that do to your department? I mean, we may have to be there. That may be the hard choice that we have to make.
Senator Nelson, if you were to cut my department by $20 million, I would be very concerned about how you would be able to manage the enterprise of K through 12 education. That you would have the confidence that you would have a Department of Education that would have the ability to not only be the accountability tool that you want us to be for this K through 12 enterprise. The demand for accountability and for information from us has grown enormously, especially with the new No Child Left Behind mandate upon us. And so while the workload has increased, our budget has been decreased for a few years now. I would be very concerned about the ability of the agency to deliver the accountability that not only the legislature wants, but that the great majority of Oregonians want and need about what's happening with their investments in K through 12. We need to have some level of management of the system. Any private sector business corporation has a certain percentage of their budget that goes to managing the enterprise. We are the management tool for the enterprise. We are the and so I guess it is your decision to make. It will be your decision to make. This hearing is about us presenting information to you, being forthcoming with whatever you need to help you make decisions you're going to make. It will be your decision on what you want to do with the Department of Education. It is a policy decision about what role you want us to play in the state of Oregon today. So we will do our best to provide you, you know, the best information we can and all the information that you need. But that is the policy decision, and it is up to the legislature to make. But I would just tell you, as the state superintendent, as I look at all of the demands on our system today, all of the demands for accountability and our efforts to gain more public support in our education system and to put more systems in place that deliver better accountability and transparency for the system, I would have very serious concerns about us being able to deliver that with an enormous cut like that.
I mean, I'm just thinking it's about $85 million now for operations for accountability. Say you took a $20 million cut, that'd be still $65 million for accountability.
Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson, I'm not clear on what numbers you're referring to.
I'm referring to the operations for the general fund is $36 million. Then there's some other fees of about $7 million. That's on line 16 at page 2. And then you have $42.5 million for federal funds for operations. And so you've got... It's about $85 million for operations out of this whole thing. And I mean, you may be entirely right, but what I'm saying, we might get down to the point where would we rather have the children not standing on the things and maybe cut you folks down and give that $20 million to those schools so they can have enough desks and enough things so that children can access. I mean, that's, I think what we have to get to the point is what's necessary and what's nice.
Absolutely. Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson, I couldn't agree with you more. We need to do everything we can to give more money to our schools and to put more money in our classrooms and to help address the issue that Representative Wisnant so passionately just talked about. You are absolutely right. I'm with you all the way on that. And we will help you as you're taking a look at our budget and trying to make those tough decisions on how we're going to accomplish that.
Just to follow, maybe we might have to cut operations, though. I mean, so that money actually goes to the classroom and doesn't stay there. Can you function in some other manner or some other way and still deliver those same services? I mean, I really think that's what we're getting down to.
Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson, I think what we are going to have an opportunity to do here is walk you through our budget, every part of it this week. And as we do that, there will be lots of opportunities for you to say, and so what's that? Do you still need to do that? And we can really break it down for you and help you as you're taking a look at this and help you figure out where you would like to make some cuts in the department's operations. Because really, the decision is going to be up to you. We've made our recommendations on where we think cuts should be made. We already went through that process in the governor's budget, which has cuts to our department in it. We took heavy cuts last session and during those five special sessions. And we know we had to do that. We were in tough economic times. And so we have sustained significant cuts in the Department of Education, and we are doing a tremendous job for the level of investment that you're making in the Department of Education. But as you go through our budget line by line, you know, you will see maybe perhaps where you could find areas that you want to see us eliminate in the Department of Education. We've made our recommendations, and we hand that to you and then ask for your, you know, your input, and you will be making that decision.
Senator Woods.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Superintendent Castillo, I truly applaud you on your efforts. It's a difficult process, I'm certain. I have one question on process and two on accountability. In rural schools, we lack many specialty classes just because there's not enough students to warrant having those classes, to be able to pay for them at an economic scale. Just for example, like Richard Wendt or Gerald Wendt, founder of Gerald Wendt, has an MA. I have a DVM. My wife has a master's from Oregon State. And we are all fully qualified to teach at an assistant professor level and university level at Oregon University Systems. But we're not qualified to teach in rural schools. I'm not suggesting that we should take a class and teach a class from A to B, A to Z all through the day. But it gives, if we were able to tap into those resources in our communities, we would be able to provide these specialized educations economically. We would provide a connection to the business community, and we would provide role models to the children. So I'm at a loss to understand why, what benefit we have from preventing that from happening.
Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsitt, you're talking about our licensure requirements in the state of Oregon, which are the Teacher Standards and Practice Commission is a separate entity from the Department of Education that does the education licensing for the state of Oregon. We work in very close partnership with them, but it is separate. And that commission makes those decisions, and we do work with them very closely, obviously. But I guess what I would say is that I absolutely agree that creating more opportunities for community members to work closely with our schools and help our kids get what they need is absolutely essential, and we need to be looking at the rules and regulations we have in place to enable us to make more progress in that area. We have, in the state of Oregon, we are known for having one of the most stringent teacher certification legislation or requirements in the country. I think Connecticut is the only other state that's seen as being more tough to get licensed in than we are. And some would see that as, wow, when you get licensed in the state of Oregon, you really have to know your stuff. You have to reach a very high bar. And yet, even with that, we still had work to do to meet the requirements of No Child Left Behind on their definition of highly qualified teachers. So there's still additional work going on to meet the requirements of the federal law, even though, as I just said, we're known for being a state that has a very high bar to have to reach to get your teacher licensure in Oregon. So at the same time that we're being told, no, it's not tough enough, you need to do these other things, we have others who are saying, well, can't you make some exceptions for more people to get in the profession and be in our schools and help? So we do get these different messages about the level of interest that people have in what should be required of who's in our schools. But I guess what I would say is I look forward to continuing to work with you and perhaps Vicki Chamberlain, who is with the TSPC, and I could come and visit you and talk with you some more about your interest in this area and just have further conversations with you about it.
Thank you. We've met the enemy, and he's us. Another question, please?
Yes.
And
Senator Walker.
On accountability, just as an example, in the Reading First State Grants, Title I, Part B, we have about $10.5 million a year is coming from the federal government for that purpose. And the Department of Education has decided to provide about $275,000 per school and 30 schools to implement that program. Well, if you do the math, that leaves about $2.3 million that's not allocated. And then the second thing about that is the average school is 310 students, K-3 students. If you do the math on that, that's about $900 per student, or about $22,500 per class of 25 students to implement the Reading First State grants. It doesn't seem like that's very accountably distributed. Just one example that I think needs to be addressed.
Okay. Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsett, I know that a good percentage, well, not a good percentage, but part of the money for the Reading First grant involves quite a bit of professional development for teachers who were involved in the program. And then there is ongoing monitoring for how they're doing. It is a very prescriptive program, that grant that has been written. And there are a number of requirements for the schools that are participating in Reading First. And Pat can tell you more about that. But most of the money that comes for that program goes out to the school and goes out for training of the workforce on how to administer that program for our students.
Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsett, it's a very good question. We'll be happy to provide you additional information on the program if you would like. You referenced the funding of the school level. It's true we have 30 schools in round one. We're actually in the process of funding phase two. We do, to participate, require mandatory professional development, as the superintendent just said. That's a different part of the grant. Third, the grant funds the Reading First Center at the University of Oregon. It's one of a handful of regional centers, and part of the function of the Reading First Center is the review of material. And this is an interesting half-full or half-empty problem. The center at the University of Oregon has developed such a national reputation that the National Reading First program now operates off of what's called the Oregon List. What this is a review of instructional material conducted by the Reading First Center at the University of Oregon, and it is of such high quality that the rest of the United States uses the review of those materials to make determinations about the purchase of Reading First material around the country. It's a requirement of the Reading First grant that material meet the conditions established by the U.S. Department of Education for Reading First material. So in addition to the funding that goes to the schools, there is a lot of activity underway in Oregon to improve early childhood literacy, and the quality of that work is achieving national reputation. We'll be happy to review each of the individual elements of that grant with you if you would like.
I would. Thank you.
Senator Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is, just to point out to Senator Nelson, as he was discussing whacking the Oregon Department of Education operations budget, which a $20 million hit would be a whack, Senator. I would point out that last week the LFO staff gave us a presentation on the increases in the budget pie, and I don't have it in this notebook. It's probably in one of the other notebooks, but if my recollection is correct, the education sector of that pie got a 0% increase from current service levels from last year. Would that be correct, Superintendent?
I can't imagine that we got an increase. It sure doesn't feel that way as we're looking at our budget. Thank you.
$100 million.
And I just pointed
Kate,
that
you're
out.
Talking about, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson, are you talking about the basic school support?
She was talking about.
Oh.
Senator Walker, Superintendent Castillo, I can clarify that. Mr. Bender pointed out to us that in absolute dollars, his belief is that the total allocation of general fund dollars, and I don't know if he included discretionary, but general fund dollars for education was the same in the 1999 biennium as the governor's budget in the 2005 biennium. Meaning that while other areas had increased, some of them not really close to increasing as much as inflation and others increasing beyond inflation, that the absolute dollars, not inflated dollars, were virtually the same in, when you added all the areas in education for 99 and when you add all the areas in 2005 biennium. And I'm going to try to verify that figure because I may start using that figure, actually. The other thing that I think Senator Walker was referring to is in terms of absolute percentages, in terms of dedication of general fund and discretionary dollars, education as a total, I think, dropped almost about 3% in terms of its relative amount of funds dedicated in the coming biennium, which is a very substantial drop. When we were looking at early versions of potential budgets, we thought a shift of even 1% in any of the major areas, public safety, education, or human services, would be very difficult to do, and the governor managed to do a 3% or close to a 3%. Senator Walker.
Yep, I thank you, Mr. Chair, for clarifying that, because I think it is important to look at, and while we need to look at your operations, Superintendent, mm-hmm. as you're more than willing to understand, mm-hmm. We can't neuter the department in such a way that you cannot deliver the services that are necessary in order to keep the programs functioning. I mean, the legislature has become a super school board, but we're not that good. So, you know, I know that all of us are going to take a close look, and as you present your budget over the next couple of weeks, we'll be looking at all those line items very carefully. But it's not just your department either. It's all of the support services mm-hmm. and the education service districts and everything that goes into it. So I think we have a big task ahead of us. Thank you.
Senator Cordley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Superintendent, on page 3 of your testimony, you indicate several priorities that are necessary to achieve a set of goals. And you have indicated as a first priority for achieving department goals that children be ready to learn upon entering first grade.
Mm-hmm.
Would you speak to what the governor's budget falls short in allowing you to meet that specific goal?
Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley, we were hoping to increase the number of children who could get into pre-K programs. We know that that is absolutely essential to helping children get a strong start in school, and that if we accomplish that, we have set them onto a path of success. And there have been a growing number of studies on It's been interesting in this area to see that, you know, for a long time we've had educators and child development specialists tell us how important it is for children to have access to pre-K, especially children from, you know, living in poverty. Now we have a growing number of economists telling us that if we put our money there, that investment will benefit us down the road. Some even say $1 there saves you $7 down the road on investments down the road. And so we did ask for an increase, and we now are looking at a reduction in the number of children that are going into pre-K in the current proposed budget. And Brett, do you want to?
Sure. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Brett West. I'm the Assistant Superintendent for Finance and Administration. The governor's budget has an $11 million reduction in the Oregon pre-K budget, and that compares to 9901 funding levels of $46.6 million. The governor's budget has $43.9 million for OPK. So that is a real cut, and we expect fewer children to be served. Rather than moving to nearly 70% as we hoped we would, we'll be closer to 52 or 53% of children, eligible children served.
And just to clarify,
yes.
Is that your top priority, that children be ready to learn upon entering first grade?
Absolutely.
That's the leader.
They're all important, Senator. I don't want to rank them, but it's very, very important that we find a way not to have those cuts happen to pre-K. That is very, very, it is a very high priority for us. And so whatever all of you can do to help us with that would be great. And it would really, I mean, for children who have that opportunity, it really makes a difference on what's going to happen for the rest of their life.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. We're getting actually on in time. If there are no additional questions, I want to thank Superintendent Castillo for being here today.
Thank you.
And actually, also, I know that there are a number of other questions that the committee may have, and I might ask you to come back in the future, maybe next week or maybe when we get into phase two. I have been given pretty clear instructions from the co-chairs to spend a considerable amount of time on performance measures for the department and actually to look fairly carefully at the proposed 10% cuts mm-hmm. and to look for any savings that the committee can find. So again, if you have any closing statement, or we'll see you probably again sometime in the near future, your presence here has been very appreciated.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. You do have a tough job this session. I know that you have very difficult budget decisions to make, and we will do our everything we can to help you with getting the information that you need to help you with that. So thank you, and I'm at your service whenever you need me back.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Could Ms. Fleming, the deputy superintendent, come forward, and also Mr. West, and we will actually try to go through your presentations, but I'm going to keep you both up here so we can hopefully get through your presentation today, and then Ms. McGlashan will have sort of an overview that I believe we will schedule now for tomorrow morning. So, Ms. Fleming, lead off whenever you choose.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Vicki Fleming, Deputy Superintendent. I want to take a moment this morning to put a little bit of a face to the department. You'll note that there is a row of folks right behind me that are managers for the Department of Education, and I want to go down the list very quickly so that you know who they are. They're here this morning for the entirety of the committee session so that they can answer any specific questions. We'll probably not be here for the entirety of the rest of the committee hearings this week, but we'll be available to you. You've already met Dr. Pat Burke, who is our Chief Policy Officer. It is the wise sage of the department with years of experience in urban school systems and is a veritable encyclopedia of information and history of the national public education scene. Brett West beside me is our Finance and Administration Assistant Superintendent and will be here with all the detail behind your budget questions. Dr. Salam Noor heads our Educational Improvement and Innovation Office. That is a combination of what was formerly three different offices and includes professional technical education, curriculum and instruction, and what was formerly known as student services but now encompasses all the federal programs for No Child Left Behind. Doug Costi is head of the Assessment and Information Services Office. He's our bilingual representative. He speaks private sector and public sector, and we'll have lots of interesting things to share with you about the assessment system and technology and the integrated data system proposal that we intend to bring forward. Dr. Nancy Latini is our Assistant Superintendent in Student Learning and Partnerships, Special Education, Early Childhood, our community schools initiative, the youth corrections education programs, long-term care and treatment all are included in her responsibilities. Dr. Bill Lottie is ahead of our newly created Systems Accountability and Policy Development Unit, which is really about getting the right information to the right people at the right time. Policy and research have become a very important aspect of the department's work. And Brian Reeder is with him. He is our representative guru on the State School Fund and the Database Initiative, which I'm sure you'll have lots of questions about. He's the Director of Policy and Research. So with that, we are probably going to have to tear through this fairly quickly this morning to get through the information that we had planned to share with you. So if I could indulge your patience in questions, our directive in phase one was to give you a high-level overview of the agency and the operation of the agency, and so that's what we're prepared to do. Specific questions about programs, we'd be happy to gather those questions and come back at tomorrow morning's hearing in the morning and go over the answers to those questions or get you additional background information, whatever you desire. It's our desire at the end of 4 days that you'll understand the following six things. First, how the education system in Oregon operates, what we do and why, what outcomes the system is responsible for achieving, the evolving relationship with education service districts, our budgets, programs, and mandates, and lastly, the basics of the State School Fund in preparation for next week's hearing. So as Superintendent Castillo said in the past, the department has had a reputation for being less than forthcoming with information, and we want you to know that we're committed to answering all of your questions in a timely manner. We value an open dialogue. We'll answer any hard question you have to throw at us, including what would $20 million mean to our operational budget. So with that, I'd like to start with a question that may be on your mind. Yes?
Ms. Fleming, so that the committee here understands some of the paperwork in front of it,
Could someone give a brief explanation so they know what's duplicative and what's new?
Brett West will provide you with an overview of what's in your notebook.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, Brett West, for the record. You have several pieces of paper that were before you when you got to your committee today, and we have been massaging our information over the last week or so. And so the first piece of information that is new is an update of the priority forms. This is a legal size document that's tucked inside the front cover. And so the one that you currently have should be discarded. This one's much better. The next piece of information that you have are the set of color slides for our PowerPoint presentation. These have been massaged greatly, so if you would put those right in front of your binder, you'll be able to follow right along with us.
Didn't have my highlighting.
Okay.
The PowerPoint slides, the thick set of the slides. And we apologize for doing this to you. We know that this isn't ideal, but given our short time frame, we want to make sure to get the best for you today. The next piece of paper will be a one-sheeter that's the appendices. It's a list of table of contents for the appendices. And you can put that right at the end of the PowerPoint presentation, right in front of the tab that says Oregon Report Card.
I think we better hire somebody.
And we do have an able committee staff who helped me do this earlier, and I'm sure she'll be willing to help do this later.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Walker.
Thank you. This makes it even more relevant that I ask this question. I've had this problem in other committees. We only have a trash in here. We do not have a recycle. And I really hate going in a trash. So maybe we could ask committee services to get a recycle bin in here.
Senator Walker, we will see what we can do. I do know that it is the practice of committee staff to collect all items after. They sometimes get into a difficult situation, as you're well aware, trying to figure out what a committee member has left that they want to retain versus what they want to recycle. So we will see what we can do in regard to that.
If we have a recycle bin, I can do it myself.
And I apologize for interrupting Ms. Fleming's presentation, but it has been my experience in Ways and Means committees that members, if they are not careful, will soon be overwhelmed with the amount of paper that they will be presented with. And so I wanted to make sure that we knew what these things were in front of us. And with that, again, apologize for the interruption. And you do have one more that you wanted to point out.
Two more. Is a two-pager that has a spreadsheet on the front and on the back page a description of Title I, Part F, Comprehensive School Reform. That goes right behind the federal funds tab. First page is right behind it. And the final piece is the minutes from the emergency board, and those go right behind the e-board tab. And I don't expect we'll have to do this again.
And with that, there's just one additional item that I will point out. Ms. McGlashan, could you point out the small or the one pager that you've distributed?
Certainly, Mr. Chair. I understand there was a question last week when Steve was doing the overview about the increase in the Department of General Fund and Lottery Fund budget from 1999-01 to what's in the governor's recommended budget for 0507. So I just prepared a one sheet explanation of that that shows you the different budget units, not including the system, in the department's budget, general fund and lottery, so that you can see where the growth has been. And as Steve surmised last week, it has been in the debt service area. There's an explanation at the bottom of the table if you have any questions. After you look at that, I'd be happy to answer.
Now, with all of that, Ms. Fleming, will you please proceed?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for that exercise in logistics. We literally have been working the last 2 weekends to gather all the information that we think will give you a comprehensive picture of what's going on in the system and at the department. So thank you for letting us add to your notebooks. So let me start. Your question might be, what does the State Department of Education do anyway? And you've already asked a lot of questions that give us a great deal of insight as to what you would like to know more about. There are a couple of words that you're going to hear us talk about often throughout the next 4 days, those being accountability and enterprise. And the superintendent already began to describe for you what we mean when we say that. The department exists to provide oversight for more than a $5 billion state school fund and more than $1 billion in federal funds, and we believe that you expect us to be accountable for this oversight and a set of outcomes. Regardless of the fact that the governance does not give us direct authority, there should be an answer for where does the money go and what do we get for it. The term enterprise is really a new way of us thinking about our work and the public investment in education. When we say enterprise, we are including early childhood, Oregon pre-kindergarten, the K-12 system, community colleges and workforce development, and the university system in our thinking. That includes a multitude of stakeholders that include teachers, school administrators, locally elected school boards, and a variety of other folks. This new way of thinking is really important to us when it's not possible financially to add new capacity to the system. We must look for ways to use our existing capacity differently. So let me give you a few examples. Consolidating multiple data centers and the technology that supports them is something that we believe would be more efficient, and that proposal we'll be discussing in more detail at later. High schools, community colleges, and universities working more closely together to share courses, faculty, and professional development is another possibility of ways we might look at an enterprise approach. Connecting early childhood programs more systemically to K-12 that would serve families and communities in a better fashion. And the enhancing of a regional delivery system by focusing on this evolving relationship with ESDs is a way that we see the enterprise evolving and being more effective and efficient. So why is that important? Basically because it's critical that we build systems that work better for students, not against them, and that we seek to find greater efficiency and effectiveness overall. In order to be accountable, the department and schools must know what standard they are expected to meet. So let's talk about standards for a minute. There are standards and there are standards. We have basically two ways that we look at that. The first being standards around students. How are students doing? We know that by setting standards for academic content, which are really about defining what students should know and be able to do. And we set performance standards, which are about the achievement level expected of students by subject and grade on a state assessment. And then we have system standards, operational standards for schools that address health, safety, and a variety of programmatic expectations. Our expectations are based on uniform standards, and we know there's disparity between the principle of uniformity and the practice that exists among 198 school districts, and you just talked about that a little bit this morning. I visited with a gentleman from the north central part of the state last week. They'd done an anecdotal overview of comparative course offerings between metropolitan or urban high schools and those in rural eastern Oregon, and his information shared that basically a rural Oregon high school has around 40 course offerings on average, and an urban or a suburban high school has around 200 course offerings. So an example of that disparity that exists. We'll be telling you about tools and processes that the department has developed to systematize both internally and externally. You'll be hearing more about the database initiative, which is really the common coding of all that all districts use to account for their expenditures, and I believe the unpacking and sharing of that will answer some of Senator Whitsett's questions about the money and how much per student we really spend. We're aware that you have ideas about the administrative rules that govern the oversight of the system, and so we'll be prepared to talk about that as well. So just for the sake of review, Oregon's educational enterprise, the K-12 portion at least, 198 school districts, 1,276 schools, 20 education service districts, 17 community colleges, 7 universities, approximately 54,000 teachers, administrators, and employees, and more than 550,000 students. This is just a map, a depiction of the density of school districts. Shows where education service districts are located, regular, charter, and alternative schools. An obvious pattern of the population, pointing out the density in the metropolitan area in the I-5 corridor. One of the major reasons for the agency transition, the evolution of the department, is in response, as the superintendent mentioned, to trigger that were changes that were triggered by Measure 5 and a state-funded system. Elected school boards approve their collective bargaining agreements and operating budgets often before you have made a decision about how much they will get. This dynamic creates a certain amount of tension in the partnership between the state in general and what was a locally controlled education system. We know that people who live in their own communities like their own schools. Recent surveys among Oregonians report that people are generally happy with their local schools but don't necessarily believe the money is always spent as wisely as it could be in the education system. In response to this knowledge, the department has adopted a commitment to transparency. Let me give you a couple of examples of that. We've recently created in Brett's office finance an interactive spreadsheet that's now available on our public website, which is a tool that school districts and school superintendents can use to project, given what number you are proposing, they can project what that would mean to their district funding. It incorporates all the variables in the state school fund, including the weights and other factors that would affect that level. In addition, we have hired in the past year an internal auditor. We've completed our first internal audit, which was really to take a very hard look at the youth corrections education programs, and we've created a corrective action plan in response to those findings. That also is posted on our public website. This map shows an obvious representation of the most money goes where most of the people live in Oregon. So you can see by distribution. This is a graph that shows the enrollment trends over time in Oregon schools. You'll note that there's been a slight drop. This goes up to the 03-04 school year. We are pretty certain that this drop is part of the end of the baby boom echo, but also could represent demographic shifts between Oregon, California, Washington, and Idaho that really follow trends of economic conditions, lots of moving back and forth to find jobs for families. We also know that over time we've experienced an increase in private and homeschool populations in Oregon. You may have read in last week's Oregonian that the Portland Public Schools enrollment has dropped by another 1,200 students this year.
Yes, Senator Walker.
Yeah, Ms. Fleming, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Fleming, could some of that enrollment growth also mean more kids have gone to private schools and charter schools that are not part of the public system?
Yes, exactly. Private and homeschool populations have increased. Charter schools would be included in the public enrollment, but private and charter would not.
Okay. Thank you.
Senator Nelson had others.
Do you have any comparison with the state of Washington? Has their school enrollment grown?
I don't, but we can get that.
Compare
Oregon and Washington enrollment growth.
One clarification, Ms. Fleming. Your graph starts in 92, 93, and I don't want to date anyone in the audience, but in the 1980s, we had a net out-migration in Oregon. Did we actually see an enrollment drop in the 1980s when we actually lost population for a portion of the 80s?
No drop.
I wasn't around at the department at that point in time, but I'm sure we have historical data that could show the trends back to, looking, I'm going to look at Brian Reeder to see if we could go back that far, and yes, we'd be happy to share. Okay. That would be the downturn of the timber industry, I believe, and the outmigration and the economy
in
general.
Downturn of practically everything in the state, actually. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The next slide really shows you the trend in enrollment growth by race and ethnicity. And I think it's a dramatic picture of Oregon's trend line. Our school population is projected to change even more over the next several years. And as the superintendent mentioned, a diverse student population and higher expectations have pressured the system to seek new strategies for teaching and learning. Meeting the needs of TAG students, English language learners, and incarcerated youth and special needs students requires specialized skill sets that demand ongoing professional development and dedicated time for teachers to work together, and that represents an investment. So a couple of high-level slides about where the money comes from and where it goes. Our agency budget is the keeper of the state school fund. The $6.4 billion really covers 440 FTE that include all of the special schools and the youth corrections education programs and the department's operational budget. The general fund portion, which you see is the biggest chunk, is predominantly the state school fund, but also includes grant and aid. $36.1 million of that is department operations. Lottery funds goes into the state school fund and provides money for the debt service on three issues of education bonds over the past legislative sessions. The other fund portion of this revenue is limited funds that are predominantly dedicated to youth corrections, education, and juvenile detention education operating funds, but include transportation, private career schools, fees, money from other agencies, and the non-limited portion is the food commodities program. The federal fund revenue represents grant and aid programs and department operations, a portion of department operations, and the non-limited portion is flow-through money for child nutrition from the U.S. Department of Agriculture. So where does that money go?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes. Representative Wisdom.
Real quick one. Sorry. Mrs. Fleming. This doesn't include local property tax. The governor, when he submitted his budget, said that he thought that the general funds amount would be offset by the increase in federal funds and the increase in local property tax. So what are we looking at? We're talking about transparencies and how much money is available for our children. How much are we looking at? It's more than 6.4 because that doesn't include the property tax. Is that correct? And would you comment on those increases?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wisnant, you're correct. This does not include the property tax portion of the state school fund. It also doesn't include the common school fund portion. The essential budget level for the state school fund was reduced was reduced in November from earlier calculations because of increases in property tax revenues. And we will get into more detail on that on Friday or Thursday when we talk about the state school fund and then the following week as well.
That'll be fine.
Please proceed.
Where is the money spent in the budget? Obviously, the state school fund is the largest component, with general fund, with lottery and other funds as well. The grant and aid portion, both federal and general funds, going out to districts and education service districts, and we'll go through that in our coming days of presentation, exactly what programs are supported with those funds. The special schools for the blind and deaf have separate appropriations that are mainly general fund. Youth corrections and juvenile detention are mainly a transfer from the state school fund, which shows up in the other fund part of the operations budget. The department operation, again, is a little more than a third of the general fund appropriation there. This is next slide shows how our operations budget has looked over the last four biennia. You can see that over the last, since 99-01 biennium, that the net reduction to the department's operational budget has reduced by about 15.5%. The agency has a policy option package that includes that proposes the K-12 integrated data system. That's a $1.8 million package. If you take that out, then the reduction is really closer to 19.7%. from the 99-01 biennium. The big drop from 99-01 to 01-03 is due to the completion of the building of the database initiative. There was a significant investment in that, building that system. This comes at the same time that there's an increase in workload due to the implementation of No Child Left Behind, and we anticipate a similar increase in workload with the reauthorization of the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. Anecdotally, our management team estimates that The implementation of No Child Left Behind has increased the workload by about 25% to 30% in the program areas and actually doubled the workload in the assessment and information services realm with increased requirements for assessment and accountability. Let me move to the superintendent's priorities. Let's start with a little bit of information about how the Department of Education is slightly different from other state agencies. We are definitely an agency that serves many masters. We serve you, the legislature, and you are responsible for appropriating the state school fund and the agency budget. We serve the governor, who appoints the State Board of Education and sets the agency budget. And we are led by an elected superintendent of public instruction who is the primary advocate for the pre-K-12 system and oversees the agency. And we must address the interests of 198 school districts, 20 ESDs, the taxpayers of Oregon, and multiple other interest groups. Our job is a big one, and it is to continue to align and respond to the interests of all those varied parties. So leadership is about setting priorities and focusing attention. And Superintendent Castillo mentioned this morning that she set very clear priorities with her administration. They're listed here: closing the achievement gap, addressing literacy, and focusing on middle school and high school reform. And in addition, she set a couple of very big challenges for the agency: to become an efficient and effective department and to focus on accountability as our number one priority. Superintendent Castillo laid out the six initiatives that were set in motion that were focused on those three priorities: the readiness for school initiative. Success for all students really is about the issues of the achievement gap, the goal being all students showing continuous individual growth in all core academic subjects, addressing the gap between high and low performing students, minority and non-minority students, and between disadvantaged children and their more advantaged peers. The literacy initiative is focused on Oregon primary students reading at grade level, and indeed all Oregon students in grades 4 to 12 learning increasingly more complex subject matter. Literacy in high school is something that we have not paid enough attention to over time, and we're focusing on that. The leadership initiative, as Susan mentioned this morning, the State Action for Education Leadership Project is a grant funded primarily with a grant from the Wallace Foundation and is addressing the cultural competency of school administrators and teachers. The Community Schools Initiative is an initiative that we're doing in partnership with the Governor's Office, the Commission on Children and Families, and several other groups, really an interagency effort to continue to build on what we know are pockets of innovation around the state that connect communities to schools and toward the goal of better educational outcomes. Middle and high school reform is an obvious initiative, creating middle and high schools that are built on the concepts of rigor, relevance, and relationships. And we'll talk more about that when we get into the state board's priorities. All this work must be done in alignment with the State Board of Education, who has set out a really broad set of outcomes over the long term in their policy discussions. The State Board was created in 1951 and sets policies and standards for pre-K-12 community colleges and ESDs. It's a 7-member board appointed by the governor for up to 2 4-year terms. Those are representatives of the 5 congressional districts and 2 representatives at large. So again, the legislature creates policy, the State Board of Education interprets policy, and the Department of Education implements that policy. The State Board is focusing on 6 major outcome areas in their policy discussions that are listed here. Common Core of Rigorous Standards is an obvious outcome. We've been in the business of creating a standards-based system in Oregon for the past dozen years. An aligned P16 system is really about that work that we talked about earlier. What is it that we can do to get more students successfully completed through their high school years and onto a post-secondary education, advanced learning, in a more seamless fashion without barriers or having to repeat coursework or having redundant expectations? The personalized learning experience focusing on individual students and what it is that they need for their success. A connected educational community is obvious, strengthening relationships again between the aspects of the system, a core of quality educators, and a system to provide adequate and appropriately allocated resources. So that's the broad policy framework. You have in your notebook the board logic model looks like this and outlines the goals of the board in your black notebook for the coming year, for 04-05. The state board's work has really evolved over the past several years and really now is focusing on, as I said, the end of high school and the beginning of the post-secondary experience. The board's work plan is aligned with the more, better, faster work of the Higher Education Board and aligns with the superintendent's priority of closing the achievement gap. In addition, the goal of accountability that you see in the bottom bullet there really has created an additional, significant additional workload to the enterprise, that meaning both to the Department of Education and to the school districts in the system. In response to that increased workload, one solution that we're proposing again is that K-12 integrated data system. The policy package in the first phase addresses the technical infrastructure consolidation. As I mentioned, there are multiple data centers and systems in Oregon. We're taking a very hard look at that. And it's designed to collect more data more consistently and with better quality. So I'm going to quickly talk about accountability, focus in and sort of give you a little more comprehensive picture of what we mean when we say that. The system of accountability in the pre-K-12 portion of the enterprise really is focused on the assumptions that you see on the slide before you. The superintendent has declared this the number one priority at the department. It was done with the recognition of the need for clarifying who is responsible for what in a state-funded system. You know that Oregon has set high expectations for its schools and students, teachers and administrators, and in order for you and the Oregonians you represent to know whether or not those expectations are being met, we must have a system of accountability. So what is a system of accountability? First, when we talk about this, we speak both to the internal operation of the department and the enterprise in general. And a system is based on clear standards, is shared, and helps us, again, think at an enterprise level about efficiencies and ways of doing things better. It's also fair and accurate. Part of this discussion has really been driven by the new environment created by the No Child Left Behind Act and the state mandates under the Oregon School Report Card. These are two mandates that overlap and can be confusing to the public. You may have remember reading in the paper in December when those, for the first time, those two designations came out in the media at the same time, the designations of which schools met adequate yearly progress and which schools did not, and which schools were rated under what term in the school report card language. It is possible in the current context for a school to be rated exceptional and to not be making adequate yearly progress for a variety of reasons which are very complicated. Superintendent has basically directed the agency to figure out a more fair and effective way of making those kinds of judgments and reporting to you what's really going on in Oregon schools. So that's a complicated undertaking, and we can tell you more about that as the week goes on. So what should a system of accountability do? It should do the three things that you see before you: accurately measure and report the performance and progress of students, schools, districts, ESDs, and the department. It should help schools and districts improve, and it should apply reasonable consequences when lack of progress becomes a pattern. The clarity around these three things has caused the department to think and do things differently. For example, we used to only collect data about schools and school districts, and now, with the mandate of No Child Left Behind, we collect data on individual students, and we collect it more frequently. Just as an aside, the last round of determining adequate yearly progress for the 198 districts and 1,200 schools, there were 50 million pieces of information about students that had to be dealt with to be able to calculate that formula in the way that we have requirements to do. In addition, the department in the past was focused on procedural and programmatic compliance. We basically said, this is what the federal government says this money should be spent on. If you are spending that money the right way and you're following the rules according to the grant, then okay. It's okay with us. The shift that we've made really is to focus on student achievement, performance, and efficiency in the system. So we're asking different questions, and we've again revised a lot of our systems and processes to accommodate being able to do that. At the department, we used to hire teachers and administrators that were knowledgeable about classroom instruction, and now we are looking for new employees as we have the opportunity to bring new people in that are skilled in research and data analysis and can give us some insight as to what all this information means so that school districts will know better. So somewhere in the system, a focus on teaching and learning and support for school improvement must happen. If it can't happen all at the Department of Education because our role has changed and our requirements have shifted, where would it happen? It really has forced us to have a different discussion about the need for a regional delivery system, and that has triggered over the last year and a half a very comprehensive conversation with the group of education service district superintendents. And again, we'll be telling you more about that in the next couple of days.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Gorley.
Ms. Fleming, I'd like to go back to page 17 and the third bullet, Oregonians support education but are unclear how funds are spent. Given what you have said to us so far about this accountability piece, I'm unclear on what are the strategies to change that reality out there in the public. The chalkboard project comes to mind as a vehicle to help educate, better educate Oregonians about the spending realities. Could you say more about that piece? Is the question clear?
Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley, yes, and we are very well aware of all of the various groups that are collecting information about what Oregonians perceive and believe to be true or not true about the education system. I think that the mention that I made earlier of our commitment to transparency is really much about addressing those concerns. What is it that we can do as a state agency to provide better, more detailed information about the state school fund, how that coding, common coding, or the chart of accounts, if you will, really can accurately report where the money comes from and where it goes. And next week, when we talk about the state school fund, we'll have a great deal of information for you about what that chart of accounts really does and how it can help you more accurately discern what happens with the money.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair,
yes.
I would just like to kind of red flag this piece for the committee. Again, just seeking more clarity about what are our strategies to convince Oregonians about how funds are actually being spent. That's what I'm trying to get at.
Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley, I think that, as you mentioned, is part of what the Chalkboard Project is about. It's about evoking a different kind of conversation with Oregonians so that perhaps they'll ask different questions. And as I think this points out, the difficulty of the relationship in a state-funded system between the Department of Education and 198 local districts in terms of what it is that we develop uniform standards for letting the general public know where that money goes. We know that we have a great deal of work to do with working with districts on that common coding of accounts, and that really is part of our work as an agency to help districts know how the reporting might work better at their level as well as at ours.
Representative
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mrs. Fleming and Mr. West, later this week, I'm all for this, and I think everyone in the state and everyone in the legislature praises your efforts for accountability. How are you going to do it? Are you going to tell us that during the week, this one internal auditor, are you going to comment on Ms. Secretary Bradbury's proposal to hire auditors? Will we get that information later in the week of how we're going to do this? We're for this. We support you. But and hopefully you won't have your 10% reduction, but how are you going to do this?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wisnett, absolutely. I think that the point of this presentation is to, again, reinforce that we are an agency in transition and that we are making the attempt to monitor, to provide oversight, to provide better reporting practices, to put systems into place that allow for that accountability to work better. And the audit function is one aspect of that. In your notebook, we did include the audits that have been completed for the Department of Education, and I actually asked our internal auditor to do an audit 101 paper that really describes and differentiates various aspects of auditing practice, performance audits from financial audits, and I'd be happy to bring that and go over that with you as it relates to the context of the public education system, if that would be helpful.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Representative, that's up to you, sir. As far as do we need more?
Well, Representative Wisnett, we will get into great detail over the next 2 weeks on a number of issues relative to the state school fund and relative to the Department of Education. And one of the things that I have gotten the go-ahead from the co-chairs is to spend more time than traditional in this area during this budget cycle, being my basic premise that when it represents more than three-quarters of the funds that this committee has purview over, we should at least spend at least a quarter to half of our time in this particular area. The other thing I wanted to mention along with that in terms of the audits, we will get a chance to look at that issue, but also my own personal frustration, and that is that the whole complexity of the system that we have makes transparency very difficult in the sense of we have funds, obviously, that I think the public understands that are coming from the state for education. We have local funds that are coming from for education. We utilize different numbers to reflect what the total level of funding is. We sometimes want to pull federal funding into this as if it was distributed across the board to every school district. And in some cases, those benefits are to all students, but in some cases those benefits of federal funds are targeted to specific students with specific needs. And so you can't really consider them as increasing the amount of dollars available for every student. So trying to explain this complex system to the average individual becomes extremely difficult. And I close with just saying that the other portion of this is we deal with this constant dichotomy of all of us at least publicly displaying our confidence in our local school boards and the value of local control at the same time as we're being asked to place more and more performance standards, and whether we use transparency to try to allow the public to see whether a school district is performing or not performing, or whether we use sanctions or incentives, you know, we often get into this debate. So it's a very difficult debate, and ultimately, every one of us is responsible in a sense, though we are responsible for the amount of for what we appropriate and how well it's spent. The school boards are responsible for how well it's spent, and so is the superintendent of public instruction. But there are, we lack some of those clear lines that you might normally see in business about accountability and trying to figure out a system that works while still valuing that value of local control is very difficult. And, yes, Senator Whitsitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I spent part of the weekend reading this performance measure and next to Oregon benchmarks. The questions that were asked of the community college and workforce group were answered pretty precisely and, I thought, adequately. Those from the Department of Education, on the other hand, were generally not answered very forthrightly, in my opinion, and as a matter of fact, the term not applicable was used over 100 times. It was my understanding that this was an exercise in being accountable to the legislature in for performance standards, and yet the questions that were asked were not uniformly, but to a great extent, simply not answered. For instance, development of the percentage of eighth graders with a completed education plan and profile, what needs to be done, not applicable. And it goes on. I think I could go on for the rest of the 10 minutes, but I wonder if you could address that, please.
Mr. Chair, Senator Woodson, absolutely. You're absolutely right. This is part of a big portion of the presentation that we have prepared for you tomorrow, but let me tell you why that is not complete. When we came, when Superintendent Castillo came into office in 2002, we were at the beginning of the last legislative session. There were no approved performance measures at all for the Department of Education. We set out to actually hired the Progress Board to come and help us go through the work of the agency, establish a set of metrics that we could begin to work with. At the same time, the superintendent said the agency needs to be reorganized and reinvented. And we've been about reorganizing and reinventing ourselves over the last 18 months. One of the criticisms that we received from the Progress Board at that particular point in time was that we had a strategic plan that really wasn't a strategic plan because we'd done nothing but talk to ourselves about it. So one of the things that we've been up to as a result of our reorganization is not only defining the work of the agency differently, but also working to gather information from all of the multiple players that I mentioned earlier. And we are in the process, in the middle of that process right now, and we'll bring back to the legislature a proposed set of approved performance measures for your approval that we believe will really measure what we want to measure and will inform our progress over time. We didn't want to put a lot of time and energy into collecting new data and new information around a set of performance metrics that weren't going to help us focus our attention on what we really know we need to do better and differently. So tomorrow, and with the indulgence of the chair and in consultation with the chair, acknowledge that we don't have good information about agency performance metrics, but what we do have in your notebook is the annual report on public education and system in Oregon, which really is a collection of all the outcome data that we know we can report on students in general, and we can go through that in detail tomorrow.
One follow-up to Senator Witsit's question. The chair, co-chairs have made it very clear to me, and I know that the department understands this, that the performance measures, well, that they want an improvement in the performance measures. So I believe the committee will be spending a goodly amount of time on that. And I believe you'll be getting close to the end of your process in terms of proposed performance measures by about March, if I'm
Mr.
correct.
Chair, that's correct, yes.
Yes, Senator Nelson.
Yes, thank you. Susan, the message that the co-chairs have given us is that, you know, we're supposed to find which programs deliver the most bang for the buck, basically. That's what we're looking at. So the testimony this morning basically was a response to a question from Senator Gourley of $11 million cut in the Head Start program or pre-K program. That there was a $7 return for every dollar spent. So we're talking about a $77 million return in addition to helping some children right now. Is it going to be possible for your organization to come in and say, okay, for every dollar that I spend on a certain program, this is going to return me $7 or $4 or $3 or something? I mean, I probably can't answer that now, but it seems to me that's what we've been charged with. I mean, we have some difficult decisions. I mean, I don't think any of us here want to cut the programs. Mm-hmm. But if we have to come down to make a choice, and our direction is where do you get the most bang for the buck, I'm going to say I want to put that money into Head Start rather than put it in the Department for Operations. You see where I'm coming? I don't mean to be mean and awful about that, but that's how I see my charge up here.
Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson, we'll do our best. We have a great deal of line item detail about the activities of the department that we didn't have 2 years ago. We can share with you exactly what happens, at least in the operational budget and in the grant and aid portion of the budget. And as a superintendent mentioned earlier, those are important policy decisions that we will grapple with together.
Senator Gourley.
Thank you. Just a quick question here, going back to Representative Wisnot's question related to audits. Mr. Chair, will we hear Secretary of State Bradbury's proposal for school district audits in this committee. It's my understanding that his proposal is asking the legislature for $1.3 million to look at auditing school districts. The goal, of course, is to find to ensure that every possible dollar is being spent in classrooms. Will we hear his proposal?
Senator Gordley, if the chair is successful, we will hear his proposal. Not to try to flex jurisdiction here, but but the Secretary of State's budget is under the General Government Committee, where it should be. Should the Secretary expand into that area of audits, the only area of revenue available to him is revenue that would be dedicated normally to the state school fund. So the subcommittee chair intends to assert some jurisdiction over that, so we at least get a joint, or not maybe a joint, but a separate discussion with the Secretary of State over that effort. So we have some confidence whether or not we should be allocating that money from the state school fund or not. With that, it is getting very close to our closing time for today. We will start tomorrow, I believe, at about page 20. And I know we have a great deal to go through in the next 3 days. I will be here tomorrow at 8:50 to confer with anybody from the Department of Education in terms of trying to keep us on schedule. And also I should point out, I never actually did introduce her, Miss Ames is here with Budget and Management. She is, for those members who are new, but not really that new, she is the governor's representative at the table. And with that, we will close this meeting, and we will come back tomorrow morning at 8:30.